Thank you. All right, so what I want to talk about here is the IMF, and at least some of you in this audience have probably seen this talk before. In fact, I'm certain some of you have, so I'm going to apologize to those of you who have seen a talk like this before. The IMF is obviously a long-standing problem in all of theoretical astrophysics, and it's a crucial component of understanding really anything to do with star and galaxy evolution. So it's something I'm mildly obsessed with. All right, so here is what I'm going to talk about here. I'm going to talk about, in particular, I'm not going to worry so much about the high mass end of the IMF. I'm going to talk about that a little, but I want to actually focus more on the low mass end of the IMF in this talk. And that's because that's actually where I think, in some ways, the hardest and most interesting part of the IMF. And I'll explain why. And I have this title, The Isothermal Conundrum, for, you know, fancy words about why I think the low mass end of the IMF is actually the hardest and most interesting problem. All right. I will then talk about two possible approaches. One which locates the physics responsible for setting the low mass IMF at the galactic scale, and one which sets it at the small scale. All right, and I'll explain as I get to it what I mean by each of these, and then I'll end with the obligatory concluding thoughts for anyone who's nodded off during the seminar. All right, so here's what we'd like to explain. All right, so here is a summary of measured IMFs for a bunch of different regions in our galaxy. All right, and each of these sets of points is a measurement for a different region. As noted, some are associations, sort of loose associations of stars. Some are dense star clusters. The line between those two is sort of in the eye of the observer. I don't think it matters that much. There's a field. There's open clusters, globular clusters. All right, and what I want you to notice is that each of these measured mass functions has two basic parts. All right, at high masses, there's a power law. All right, and this power law is within the uncertainties about the same in each of these regions. All right, and in all of these regions, this power law then has a break, a plateau, a turnover, something where it stops being a power law. All right, right here. All right, and we see that all the time. So we always get at high masses this power law part. All right, and the slope of this power law is about minus 2.3. It's the standard saltpeter slope that you all learned about. And then there's this break, and this break is always somewhere between a tenth of the solar mass and a solar mass. All right, exactly where it is depends on whose pre-made sequence stellar evolution model you like and on numerous details of how you make your corrections for various things, but it's always sort of 2/10 of a solar mass. All right, that's the most common mass for a star to have. All right, so what I'm looking for in a theory of the IMF, I'm not demanding, I don't want to know the exact functional form. I want a theory that will tell me, where does that come from? Why is that mass special? Why is a few tenths of a solar mass special? All right, now, there is this distinctive mass scale. Now, where does this come from? And the explanation that you might get if you sort of, you know, ask a random person or a random astronomer, probably not a random person on the street. That would be surprising. You ask a random astronomer, like you ask a cosmologist, this is probably the answer that, you know, and you sort of force them to answer.
It's the closest to a man in the street.
That's right. You ask a random cosmologist, you'll get some, you know, look of panic, and then they'll probably come up with some explanation about the genes mass. All right, and they'll say something like, well, it's something like the genes mass in star-forming clouds. And if you sort of, you know, stick a pen in their hand and force them to sit down and work it out, they'll do this. They'll say the genes mass is something like, you know, this thing. And then they'll say, well, all right, temperature in molecular clouds, it's about 10 Kelvin. I'll put in a density, you know, it's a reasonable density, 10 to the 5. And look, 0.3 solar masses. Yay, I'm done. All right, now, the problem with this explanation is that it's totally and completely bullshit. All right, and the reason it's bullshit is that, well, all right, how did you know to put in this density? Molecular clouds in the local universe have a roughly constant temperature.
You adjust the data, right?
Well, the problem is that it depends on which data you put, right? There isn't, you know, there isn't. Yeah, exactly. So you knew the answer in advance, and you picked the density that would match it.
Yes.
All right, but if you didn't know the answer in advance, right, well, what's the density in a molecular cloud? Well, you can pick out any sort of density and find it, right? You can pick out 10 to the 5 because, yeah, you can find gas at 10 to the 5, but how did you know to put that in? Well, you were cheating, all right? And if you didn't know that, all right, you could have picked any other density, and maybe you would have picked, you know, I don't know, 10 to the 2, and you'd have concluded the typical mass is 13 solar masses, right? So the average star is an O star.
But the Higgs mass is irrelevant to know because it's highly turbulent. So what matters is the sonic length and the mass and the sonic length.
Right, so I'm going to get to that. I'm going to get there.
Okay.
I'm getting there.
Cosmologists don't know that.
I'm a cosmologist, I don't know that.
Have faith, it's coming. All right, it's coming. All right, so now this is telling you something useful and interesting, and what it's telling you is that there's not enough physics to get this answer. All right, now, I can put this a little more mathematically. Suppose that I think that molecular clouds can be described as isothermal, magnetized, self-gravitating structures. All right, so here's the set of equations that describe them. All right, continuity, here's the momentum equation, including magnetic forces and gravity, the induction equation, Poisson equation, right? So, all right, so if you're trained in fluid dynamics, the first thing you do is you look at this and you say, what are the dimensionless numbers here? So you non-dimensionalize these equations. All right, and when you do that, you learn that there are three dimensionless numbers in this problem. All right, you can write them in various ways. The way I've chosen here is the Mach number, the Alphain Mach number, and the virial ratio. All right, you can think of these as being ratios of energies. Right, the Mach number is telling you about the ratio of kinetic energy to thermal energy. The Alphain Mach number is telling you about the ratio of kinetic energy to magnetic energy. And the virial ratio is telling you about the ratio of kinetic energy to gravitational energy. All right, there are four energies in the problem. I can make three-dimensionless ratios. That determines everything. All right, so the reason for going through this exercise is now I can do the following. I can say, all right, these dimensionless numbers determine everything. All right, and in one line of algebra, you can convince yourself that these dimensionless numbers are unchanged by the following rescaling. I'll multiply the density by some factor x, the length scale by that same factor x to the minus a half, the magnetic field strength by x to the minus a half. All right, and if I do that, all of these dimensionless numbers stay exactly the same, so I haven't changed the problem at all, but I've changed the mass scale by a factor of x to the minus a half. All right, now this has a practical implication. All right, and here I've written it as isothermal gas has no mass scale, but let me put this in a, you know, sort of more practical terms. Someone comes and does an isothermal simulation, and they say, look, I reproduced the IMF. Look, I got, you know, a nice power law, and there's a break, and there's the peak at the right place. Well, you can ask, why is that peak there? Because really, they did their simulation in dimensionless units, right? So what determined the location of the peak? And the answer is, whatever they chose for the initial conditions in the simulation, when they rescaled it from dimensionless to dimensional units. All right, but how did they know to make that choice? Everything about the IMF is entirely contained in when I took my dimensionless simulation output and rescaled it to a dimensional value, what numbers did I choose to assign for the size of the box, the density of the box, etc.? And I could have made those choices in many, many different ways.
No,
I can't. Okay, Aki, I understand. I'm getting there. I'm getting it. Yeah. We've had this discussion before. Aki is one of the people who's seen this talk before. Okay, let me put it this way. Your prediction of the theory of the location of the IMF peak is only as good as your ability to decide what numbers you should pick when choosing the length of your box and the density of your box, etc. The entire content of your prediction for the location of the IMF peak is entirely within how you choose those numbers.
Maybe there is a right choice.
So maybe there is a right choice. So how do you make that choice? All right, so here are a couple of ways to do this. All right, so you need some extra physics. Isothermal MHD with gravity does not contain enough physics to explain the peak of the IMF. How do you choose that scale? So one is you say, well, somehow, something in the properties of the galaxy picks it out, right? So galaxies make molecular clouds for some reason. There's some physics that decides molecular clouds should have some particular length scale or density scale or something, and that's what picks out the peak of the IMF. That physics is everything when it comes to locating the peak of the IMF. That's one option. All right? A second option is you can say, well, all right, isothermal MHD is not an exact description of what's going on inside a molecular cloud. It's only approximate. All right, and I can give up the assumption of isothermality. All right, if I do that, that introduces a scale into my problem. All right, and you can give up that assumption of isothermality in a couple of ways. You can say, well, all right, maybe due to dust-gas coupling or opacity effects or something, that causes a deviation from isothermality. Or you can say, well, all right, stars radiate, they heat up the gas around them, and that causes a deviation from isothermality. All right, so how you explain the IMF really comes down to which of these routes you choose to follow. Now, I'm going to argue this third one is the best, and there are people in this room who are going to disagree with me violently, and that's okay. I'm going to make the argument for why I think these two approaches are not, in the end, going to be successful. All right, so let's start with the galactic hypothesis, and there are a couple of versions of this. And I'll start with this one from Matthew Bate. All right, and the idea is that basically molecular clouds have some characteristic density, and that gives them a genes mass, all right? And that characteristic genes mass is what sets the peak of the IMF. And so the basic idea is that there's a characteristic density scale for molecular clouds. I calculate the genes mass with that density scale. Good, that gives me the IMF. All right, so there are a number of authors who've pursued this hypothesis. I think that there are a couple of problems that it runs into. All right, so one is that it implies the IMF has to become increasingly top-heavy at higher star formation rates and higher redshifts, and that's simply because the temperature is going up, and so the genes mass is going up, right? So if you pursue this hypothesis, then what you predict is an IMF that gets increasingly top-heavy, either in regions where the gas is, in any place the gas is significantly warmer than 10 Kelvin. All right, and that could be, for example, in a U-lerg. Right, in a U-lerg, the gas is probably more like 50 Kelvin or something like that. All right. Or if I go to a higher redshift where, say, the CMB temperature is higher. All right, now maybe you can get out of that by making the density higher to compensate. But then if you want to keep the IMF the same, you need to have a good reason why the density and the temperature know about each other in such a way as to make this cancellation happen. You're sort of invoking that there's some magic that makes the density and temperature scale with one another in such a way as to keep the genes mass the same.
Do we know that the IMF is universal at higher redshift?
Well, we don't know that it's exactly universal, but all right, let me point out these yellow points. Those are globular clusters, right? So now, of course, all the massive stars are dead, but you can certainly rule out, for example, an IMF that peaked at 5 or 10 solar masses, all right? And that's because globular clusters would look way different, all right, if the IMF, at the time they formed, peaked at 5 solar masses.
You're just seeing this. You don't really see the drop, right? So this first one is probably the error bars
Yeah. Yeah, well, but you can rule out, so you can rule out an IMF that peaked at 5 solar masses in globular clusters in a lot of ways. One is the chemical abundance patterns would be completely different. All right, another is that the globular cluster would probably not still be here because stellar mass loss would have been so severe that it would have unbound the cluster, right? So, yeah, I mean, certainly could it be different by a factor of 2 or 3? Sure. You can't rule out that it was, you know, if you told me the IMF in a globular cluster didn't peak at 0.3, it peaked at 0.6, I would say, sure. All right, but you can't...
Are you saying that we get exactly the same value?
No, I'm saying I'm not claiming that I know it's exactly the same. I'm claiming it's not changing by more than a factor of 2 or 3. All right, I think, and you know, a factor of 2 or 3 you can live with. An order of magnitude is a problem.
You're indirectly implying that other theories will predict a larger difference.
Well, there's that T^3/2. So go ahead.
This is not a theory. This is just a scaling relation. That's not the theory for the IMF.
All right. Well, you need to, if you have a theory, let me put it this way. If you have a theory, you need to subject it to the test. Does it run into a problem if I start putting in gas temperatures like I see in U-lergs or like I expect to have in a Z4 galaxy?
U-lergs. Gas is also denser. It's a fact. You don't have to invoke some
sure. And then you need
those two. They cancel.
They go in canceling directions. But unless you have a good reason why.
It's just a fact. It's not. You don't need a reason for it.
Well, they go in the same direction. But you need a reason why the cancellation works out in such a way as to keep the peak from moving by more than a factor of 2 or 3.
Just put the numbers in. You won't get more than 2 or 3.
Yeah, you will.
No, I mean, you go from, say...
What density did you want to put in for the U-lerg again?
Multiply it by 100 or so.
Why did you choose that number as opposed to... We have the same...
Observation.
observationally. I mean, we just heard a talk from Serena who told us about she's modeling 10 to the 6 in Euler's, and there certainly is gas at 10 to the 6. And there's gas, exactly, it depends on the scale. So how did you know what density you wanted to put in without knowing the answer? This is, we're back to that again.
I think that's too strong of a statement, but
when you said the MS peak at the Jeans mass,
yeah.
It's not at the Jeans mass, it's proportional to the Jeans mass.
Or it's proportional to, yes. In these models, it's proportional. Well, it depends on whose model you're using. In Bate and Bunnell 2005, they claim the peak is at the Jeans mass in their initial climate.
Then they must have used a very high density.
They did. Well, they were simulating, here's the simulation. They started at a density of 10 to the 4 or 5 or something like that.
So it's probably a smaller one you talk about.
Yes, this is, yeah, I mean, this is, you probably can't read the scale here, but this is, well, this is a column density, so like the color scale here, so like this is, you know, so down here that's 1 gram per square centimeter.
And if you remember, their simulations failed miserably to predict the low mass part anyway, if we do much too many brown dwarfs.
Well, they do get too many brown dwarfs, but again, that's a function of, do they get too many brown dwarfs? Well, that's they could have changed, they could have rescaled and gotten exactly the right number of brown dwarfs. Right? Again, there's nothing in these simulations that has a characteristic density scale in it. So the simulation is dimensionless. They could have said, all right, we're just going to rescale, and then they wouldn't have overproduced brown dwarfs anymore. Right? Do you disagree with that statement?
We can talk about that.
Okay.
Then you might scale out of the Larson relation.
All right, so the Larson relation. Thank you for the nice segue for me. All right, so in fact, here, I'll skip this. All right, we'll go ahead to the Larson relation. All right, so the second sort of conjecture is that, well, all right, so you say, all right, maybe it's not the Jeans mass in the cloud. Maybe it's something like a turbulent Jeans mass. All right, it's the Jeans mass not at the mean density, it's the Jeans mass at the peak of the density media. All right, and if you work through exactly what that implies, you find that then you predict a peak whose mass depends on the normalization of the line width size relation. All right, now for those of you who are not galactic astronomers, there's this well-known relation in galactic molecular clouds that if you measure the velocity dispersion in a region of a particular size scale, you get some value. All right, and if you change the size scale of the region you're measuring the velocity dispersion over, you get a different value. So there's a proportionality between the two, which goes roughly like velocity dispersion is like size scale to the 1/2 power. All right, so that's called the line width size relation, and it has some particular normalization. All right, and that normalization, it turns out, which I've written here as sigma sub parsec, what is the velocity dispersion at a size scale of 1 parsec, that normalization is what picks out the peak of the IMF. All right, now, that's one way of writing it. An equivalent way of writing it is to say, well, all right, if I demand that my clouds are virialized, it turns out that for a virial parameter of 1, there's a 1-to-1 relationship between this number, the line width size normalization, and this number, the surface density of the cloud.
The virial number is not 1.
If it's of order unity. All right. There is a relationship between this and this. All right. This number is not exactly constant either. In fact, I'll get to that in a second. These are two equivalent ways of writing it out, all right, and which one you like depends on who you are. So, all right, so I put up all these, so Paolo and Aki have a model like this in which they express it this way. If you go to Phil Hopkins, he expresses it this way, all right. But the mass scales they're predicting in all of these models are exactly the same modulo factors of order unity. All right, and they all have exactly the same scale, all right. You can write it out as the mean density Jeans mass over the Mach number, because that's the Jeans mass at the peak of the density PDF. You can write it out this way or this way. They are, in fact, all the same, except for factors of order unity. All right, and so here is Aki and Paolo's model, where they've predicted an IMF for different line zero for different Mach numbers, and this is for a particular molecular cloud length scale and density. All right, and I think Aki would argue that only one of these is sort of on the line with size relation. Only one of these Mach numbers for these particular numerical parameter choices. And so that picks out where the peak of the IMF is. Is that fair to say?
No.
No? Okay. All right.
Well, it's a question of three parameters that need to play together. So for these two fixed parameters,
for these particular ones that happen to be in this panel of this figure that I lifted from your paper.
Exactly.
Okay. Right.
What's beta there?
Beta is the slope of the velocity power spectrum.
So you assume implicitly that you have one star per turbulent collapsed core.
I would agree with that. I don't know if Aki would agree with that, and it's his model, so I'm going to let him agree or disagree. I will let Aki respond to that. This is Phil Hopkins' model, all right, and this is an excursion set formalism, all right, where he tries to do something like a Preschecker and excursion set model for the turbulent gas. And again, you get, you know, these different IMFs where the peak is moving around as he varies these parameters. All right, so now this has some appealing characteristics because there is observed to be in the Milky Way, if you look at CO defined molecular clouds, there is in fact a sort of universal one with size normalization in the Milky Way for molecular clouds observed in the CO 1 to 0 line. Now, those are two very, very important caveats, all right? Because if you change your molecule or your region, you do not get a universal line with size relation. All right, so here, for example, is some data from Yancey Shirley, and this is C34S. All right, and here is the line with size relation they measure in these regions of high mass star formation. All right, now, here is the normalization. Here, down here, where they've listed as low mass is your sort of normal line with size relation that you get with CO. All right, here's, you know, so at a size scale of about a parsec, you get a velocity dispersion of about a kilometer per second.
What's
C34? It's sulfur 34. It's optically thin. You want to do this experiment with an optically thin tracer because otherwise, you know, you don't necessarily get, you have to worry about optical depth effects in measuring your velocity dispersion. So it's an optically thin isotope in order of CS. All right. So here is what you actually measure if you pick a different molecule and a different sort of region. Right? So here you get, you know, up here, but in these regions you actually get something like a factor of, you know, 3 to 5 to 10, depending on exactly how you measure it, higher. All right, so now these regions are maybe a little bit warmer, but they're not a factor of 5 warmer than the other regions. And all right,
but the regions where you already see massive stars could be affected by feedback, so it's not the conditions from which the EMF emerge, right? It's already
But star formation is still ongoing in these regions. These are not, you know, these are clearly gas-dominated regions. Yes, maybe they've been affected by feedback. That could well be the case.
The Standard-Larsson relation is very statistical. It's been measured in different galaxies, and it's always the same, right?
It's not the same from galaxy to galaxy. Not even close to the same.
Balabe et al. Was very close, right? They combine different GMCs and put them on.
Yeah, so it's similar if you look at galaxies that look like the Milky Way. But if you look at, for example, the stuff... To give you a specific example, all right, if you look at the stuff that's been done with ALMA on the antennae, the normalization of the line with size relation is totally different.
Okay, but that's the starburst part that you have. But I mean, if you look at SMC, LMC, IC10, nearby dwarf galaxies, they all lie on the same relation. Starbursts are different because the ASM, as you know, is very pressurized.
Right? The Milky Way center does not lie on that relation, right?
Fine, but it's not forming stars.
Yes, it is.
Well, a little bit. Yeah.
It's forming stars. It's not forming stars as fast as you might expect for its density, but in fact, probably sort of a third of the total star formation budget of the Milky Way is in the central molecular zone.
Well, but also it's like right next to the black hole, the IMF doesn't seem...
No, I'm not in the one parsec ring. I'm talking about the CMZ at, you know, 100 parsecs from the black hole. All right. That's where all the star formation is. The one parsec ring is tiny.
Starburst is not a good example because there is some indication that in progenitors of ellipticals, the two starbursts, IMF is different.
Maybe a little bit. Maybe a little bit, not by a lot, and there is no evidence, for example, if you go to, again, you know, you're not allowed to change things by factors of 10, maybe factors of 2 or 3, all right? The point I'm making is that even in these regions within the Milky Way, all right, which are still forming stars. And yes, maybe they've been affected by feedback, but they are still forming stars if your theory says that this is the key parameter. Right.
But where are those regions when you look at sigma L relation for GMCs in different nearby galaxies? Where are those regions? You don't see factor 10.
Oh, I mean, sure. That's because you're using CO, right? These are regions measured in. So is CO the magic molecule? Why? Why do you prefer the CO measurements to the CS ones?
Because it gives us the largest unit of star formation, the GMC, right?
That's why is that the relevant quantity?
Well, what kind of regions is this molecule tracing?
These are actively star-forming clumps. So I can be precise. This Shirley sample is selected for regions of active massive star formation, so it's a maser-selected sample. All right, so.
CS has a critical density that traces the gas that is forming stars much more than CO. It's to do with the critical density.
So it's higher density.
Yeah, these are higher density regions.
Yeah, but you may miss, indeed.
Well, maybe it is, but again, if you're, I mean, these are clearly regions that are undergoing collapse.
Are you in the turbulent picture, so large scales, when you're not affected by collapse, you have the up to one-third scaling, which is normalized to some value, and then when you go to deep, denser regions, then you see collapse.
Right, but these are not single cores though. These regions have masses of 10 to the 4 m sun or 10 to the 3 m sun. These are proto clusters, not proto individual stars.
No, but maybe the line width.
That's right, but why? I mean, you have to have some good theoretical reason why you want to choose the line width at, you know, cluster scales versus GMC scales. Why is one relevant and the other not? Again, I think it's coming back to, you know, you know the answer you want to get.
No, but isn't it more like an observational issue, more than a theoretical issue?
Mm-hmm. Well, no, I mean, these really are the velocity dispersions in these regions.
The theoretical picture is that you have a turbulent spectrum, the previous slide, sigma, is the turbulence normalization, the normalization of the turbulence.
Right, but these regions don't lie on that normalization.
Yeah, but maybe it's an observational bias. You're probing different regions.
Why is one? I don't understand why you think that this is biased and CO is not biased.
Oh,
why?
Is biased.
Well, but then.
It's an interesting discussion, but I think it's fair to say that it is not his own theory.
Yeah, no. And I'm actually happy to argue about this. I don't have that many slides because I figured this was going to happen. All right. The point I'm making is that, I mean, what I dislike about this approach is that it requires you to do something like say, CO is the one true molecule, and I'll use the line width size normalization that comes from it, as opposed to CS or HCN or any of the other ways you can go about measuring the line width size relation. Or it requires you to say that I'm going to use the line width size relation I see in the Milky Way and not in starbursts. All right. It requires picking things out. It requires special pleading. All right.
But you don't sample the IMF from starbursts, right?
Sure. We okay. So first of all, we do have direct measurements of the IMF in regions like R136, for example, which are pretty starbursty. All right. They're not. It's not ARP220, but you can measure the IMF in R136, and it does not have a peak that is wildly different than it is in the Milky Way. All right, so an R136, I can tell you the surface density of R136 is not the surface density of a Milky Way GMC. All right, I can tell you the stellar surface density. So even after you've gotten rid of all the gas, the stellar surface density in R136 is above a gram per square centimeter. All right, so you need a theory that explains R136. All right, where there's a direct star counting measurement.
Mark, so all those molecules are biased, right? But one of them is the less biased. Maybe CO is less biased than the rest of them, and so it better represents the true density distribution, or full density distribution, for example.
Well, I think.
So it can be that one of them are actually the better than the others. They're all equal, but one of them may be better.
Well, okay. I mean, I think that you need to then define what constitutes better.
Well, you know, there's a true I'm looking in the sky. There's true distribution of cone density, for example, in this region.
Yeah.
So maybe it's represented by CO distribution better than they see it.
I think
it's a good question.
The way I think about this is, you always, since this is basically a fractal medium, right? You can't talk about meaningfully about the column density without specifying a scale over which you're averaging.
Yeah, for given scale, sure.
Right. So different molecules are probably better representations of different scales, and that's fine. But then you need a reason why, in your theory, you like one scale and not another, right? Like why you need.
I can imagine. I don't know if it's true or not, but one of the molecules might be better at those scales.
Well, but what scale? What scale are you interested in?
But if I go to I form a single star, that's not an IMF, right? When I talk about IMF, the measurement is a short.
That's fine.
It's a measure to a certain scale.
That's fine, but these are not cores. These are protoclusters. Each of these objects have a mean mass of several thousand solar masses.
Clusters have half mass radii of a parsec, 3 parsecs.
These are protoclusters.
This is 0.3 parsecs.
These are protoclusters. Yeah, they're going to form
tiny clusters.
Yeah, well, but the typical star cluster is born at that size, right? They get bigger later, but if you go look at like the core of Orion, the core of Orion has a half mass radius of parsec.
But there is a scale.
This is a proto Orion.
What you're saying, there's not how you choose a scale. Well, the scale you choose is the one over which you're measuring IMF. So when you measure IMF,
well, all right, fine. This is the scale of Orion, so I want to use this normalization of the line width size relation.
I want to get at the second point.
All right. I'm going
to
go on.
Let me get to the second point.
Yeah. All right. So this is one approach, and it's historically, I mean, I think part of the reason that there was so much attention paid to this is because this is historically the approach that galaxy people have tended to use. All right. And that's because it locates the peak of the IMF in something on galactic scales. All right. There is another approach, which is to say, well, all right, let me not try and somehow find a magic scale that's going to set all my normalizations and fix everything. Let me instead say, well, isothermality is only an approximation. I'm going to deviate from it. I'm going to relax that approximation. All right, and maybe that relaxation of the approximation is what sets the peak of the IMF. All right, and so how do you go about doing this? Well, there are a couple of different ways. All right, so here's someone in the room. All right, here's a calculation of temperature versus density as a function of metallicity. And this is in a sort of idealized one-zone calculation. All right, and what you see is that at very low densities here, you're sort of atomic, you cool down, and then if I focus on, this is the solar metallicity line. All right, so I get cold, and then I sort of get a little bit colder, and then I start warming up. And what causes this kink here is where the density becomes high enough that dust and gas start talking to one another. All right, so at low densities, dust and gas don't collide often enough for their temperatures to be coupled, and I become slightly sub-isothermal. All right, that is, as I get denser, I get colder, and that's because my heating is dominated by things that go like density to the first power, like cosmic rays. My cooling is dominated by collisional processes that go as density to the second power. So I get cooler, I get denser, cooling winds more, and I'm sub-isothermal. Then I start to couple the dust. That stops mattering anymore. But as I get denser, I'm collapsing faster because my free fall time goes down and stuff warms up, and that gives me this slightly super isothermal part. All right, and here is a similar calculation in a 3D simulation by Glover and Clark, and you again see this sort of kink associated with density coupling. All right, and the conjecture is the following. All right, these places where there's a kink, and you could focus on this one, or you could focus on, say, this kink. This kink is caused by the gas becoming optically thick to its own cooling radiation. These kinks in the equation of state are special. All right, and the reason they're special, well, among other things, you could say, well, all right, imagine I have, say, a filament of gas, and this is an argument from Richard Larson, and I take this filament and I let it start contracting and cooling. All right, and as long as gamma is less than 1, all right, this filament is capable of contracting infinitely, and it'll contract sort of indefinitely. But once gamma becomes bigger than 1, it turns out filaments are stable. You can't compress them anymore. All right, so that'll cause this filament to, rather than compressing axially like that, to break up into blobs. And of course, for spheres, we know spheres are unstable to collapse below gamma of 4/3. All right, so maybe this transition in gamma, which is the slope of this thing, causes things to break up, and that is what gives me the IMF. All right, and here are some of the papers that have explored that idea. All right, and here's some, in fact, numerical support for it. All right, so here are some simulations from Katerina and Yapsin, and what they did in these simulations is they just took turbulent boxes, and they just changed the equation of state. So everything about these simulations is identical except the equation of state, and they just artificially moved where they made the transition from slightly sub-isothermal to slightly super-isothermal, right? So they have an equation of state that's got a sub-isothermal branch and a super-isothermal branch, and they just change the density at which that transition occurs. And they look at the IMF that comes out, all right? And here's one simulation, the next simulation, the next simulation, and again, the only thing that's changing between these is where this transition occurs, and that's indicated by this vertical line. This vertical line is the genes mass calculated at the density where you go from sub-isothermal to super-isothermal. And what you see is that the mass distribution in these simulations is sort of following that line. All right, as I move that line to higher masses, the IMF follows it as I move it to lower masses.
The upper two bounds are just noise. I mean,
what?
The upper two bounds are just noise. I mean, where is the line forward?
Here's the histogram. The histogram is the measurement. Is it your claim you form fewer objects here because they're more massive? But I mean, is it your claim that this histogram and this histogram are consistent with one another?
I think they're consistent because the statistic is very low in the upper.
I am very confident that if I did a KS test and asked, are this and this consistent with being drawn from the same distribution, the answer would be no. If you'd like, I'm perfectly happy to get the data and do the KS test for you after the talk.
So you don't have the lot of stars with small masses, so in that respect you can probably wait. But I don't think you can say that it follows the line.
I think I can say with confidence that the median of this distribution is higher than the median of this distribution. All right. It's going in the right direction. There is clearly some sensitivity to this parameter, and it is in the direction you would expect. All right. Happy with that? All right. And here are some calculations from David Gusenyov. This is in a semi-analytic model. All right. And this is showing, again, as you change the equation of state, all right, you see this peak sort of moving in different places and the shape changing. All right. Here are some calculations from Patrick Hennebel and Gilles Chabrier's theory. And again, as you change the equation of state, you get different shapes there. All right, so the shape and the location of the cutoff seem to be sensitive to the equation of state you adopt. All right, so this, to me at least, seems like fairly convincing evidence that the equation of state matters. All right, that you can't try and explain the peak of the IMF without thinking a little bit about what the temperature density relation of your gas should be. All right, so I regard this as pretty convincing. Maybe not everyone agrees with me. All right, now, there's a problem, though, with treating this as an equation of state. All right, the results are very sensitive to exactly what equation of state you assume, and the problem is that this is not something that is really well approximated by an equation of state. And the reason I say that is that if you actually think about what dominates the temperature distribution of the gas, what's setting the temperature of the gas? All right, well, the answer is, in the Milky Way, it's starlight. It's stellar radiation. All right, and the reason is simply that, all right, these equations of state, all right, that this one, are computed for just a sort of mean galactic UV background, right? There's no local sources here. All right, but as soon as you have a local source, the temperature distribution responds much more to it than to any background you can put in.
But you shouldn't even call them equation of state. They're not equation of state.
Well, okay, runs of temperature versus density. Yes. Okay, yes, they're not true equations of state. You're right. All right, but you can't even describe things in terms of a run of temperature versus density once you have local stellar sources, because, of course, it matters where you are. All right, and that's illustrated here. These are some calculations of mine, and this is just showing, in a simulation that includes radiative transfer, what is the distribution of temperature and density? And you see that, you know, good luck finding any sort of relation between temperature and density here. It's a total mess, right? And it's a total mess because it matters where you are, right? I can have gas that's at, you know, fairly high density but happens to be far from the stellar source, or I can have gas that's at the same density but happens to be close to the stellar source, and the temperatures will wind up being very, very different. All right, so just for comparison, I put up here some of the proposed equations of state that people have, you know, equations of state in scare quotes that people have used. All right, here's one, and, you know, yeah, it just doesn't look like reality. And the reason, again, has to do with the energy budget. So this is from a calculation of Stella Offner's, and it's just showing, all right, if I take a turbulent box where stars start forming, what are the energy input rates from various sources? All right, and here is the energy input rate from, say, viscous dissipation. Here's the energy input rate from adiabatic compression. And as soon as stars turn on, here's the energy input rate from stars.
These are stars within the clouds?
Yes, these are stars within the clouds. And these are not massive stars, just to be clear. This calculation doesn't form any massive stars. These are like one-tenth of a solar mass things. All right, but the reason they can totally dominate the energy budget is that they've got really, really deep potential wells compared to a molecular cloud.
So what is setting the lower boundary at
20K? In this simulation, it is that we just imposed an external radiation field coming in from the outside.
Okay, so that keeps the gas.
Yes, that keeps the gas from cooling below that. So that's basically, this is the galactic background we're imposing.
But you have some gas which is below that.
Yeah, so stuff can temporarily drop below that, basically, if it adiabatically expands. It doesn't instantaneously return to equilibrium.
Okay.
So you can be out of equilibrium below that temperature. Is there another question? Yes.
So this simulation includes relative transfer.
Yes.
The way you propagate the radiation field is not deciding where the local sources are, but just taking an average field?
No. So in this simulation, what's going on? Right. So in this simulation, what's going on is, so we're doing the radiative transfer with an approximation called flux-limited diffusion.
Right. Mm-hmm.
All right. And we have both an externally imposed radiation field, and once we form stars, we have point sources of radiation.
Right.
Okay. So that's how the temperature is being calculated by. So the stars are sources in the FLD solve.
Yeah, but my point is that every time you do a calculation in this way, I mean, you do relative transfer, you know that the local effects matters because this is relative transfer, right? So the point is, if you put the sources in the right place, I mean, the problem is in deciding where the sources are and the properties they have.
Well, they're not put in by hand. They're being calculated self-consistently in the simulation.
Self-consistently.
What I mean is, in the simulation, we start with gas but no stars. We have gravity. Where the gas collapses, we put in stars. We calculate the properties of the stars using a stellar evolution code.
Sure, but you decided how the star formation occurs at some point, and you do the relative transfer with the assumptions on the stars, and after, what do you claim in the end about the IMF?
Well, from this simulation, nothing, because these simulations, I'm gonna get there. These simulations, these particular simulations I'm showing here did not form enough stars that I can meaningfully extract an IMF from them. I will show you in a moment a simulation where I do form enough stars that I can meaningfully measure an IMF.
Because this is what happens when you do relative transfers. I mean, this is not unusual. It's all the time. It depends on the claim that you do for the sources.
Well, the point I'm making is that when you do a calculation where you do your best at having the stars form where gravity says they should form, and calculating the luminosities of the stars from a stellar evolution model, you find that the stars dominate the temperature structure. That's my claim. Well, but that's not, I mean, but that's an important point. I mean, it may seem obvious to you. You know, it is not obvious to the people who are making models using these equations of state. All right, because, you know, so this is the point I'm making, is that if you think the equation of state, if you think the temperature density structure is the key thing in determining the IMF, then you are forced to think about radiative transfer effects. Maybe you regard that as obvious. If you had been at star formation conferences for the last decade, it has not been.
So, back to the compression, the energy budget from compression. Could this be also very sensitive to the resolution of the simulation? Because if you have a higher resolution, you can follow the collapse. Then the PDV locally can be quite strong. And then radiation from this PDV thing will propagate to larger scale. And then you can have, without having protostellar sources explicitly included, you could have a pretty strong.
Well, if you went down to, so if you had enough resolution that you were modeling the stuff as it compressed down to stellar densities, I would agree with you. But the key thing is that, right, I mean, the energy is right, the energy is all in the last 1 over R. Right? I mean, since the potential goes like 1 over R, the energy is all in the last decade of the collapse.
Yeah, I agree.
So you need to resolve. So yes, if you could resolve down to the, you know, if you could resolve the stars, you wouldn't need the direct sources, I agree.
Yeah,
but no one can do that.
The protostellar radiation field comes from compression of heating at the radiative shock.
Yes. So if you could resolve that, you wouldn't need this.
Yeah,
I agree. But
it's just a terminology.
It's when I say protostellar sources, I should be clear, it's the accretion luminosity onto the stars that matters.
But these are massive protostars.
Right? No. Tenth of a solar mass.
Tenth of a solar mass.
That's the typical, in this simulation, that's the typical mass. A few tenths of a solar mass.
Right?
They're deeply embedded. They're tenth of a solar mass, they're just accreting a lot because they're still forming. All right, so
the radiation is not coming out.
Well, the radiation is coming out of the star, but then it's getting trapped by the dust and gas around them.
And lost.
Yes. All right, so here is just, you were asking him about this, all right. So here is just a calculation of what you in fact expect for the sort of temperature distribution around one of these sources, all right. So this is just a 1D calculation, all right, using a setup much like the Omokai simulation, the Omokai calculation I showed you, but now once the star turns on. All right, so here is the temperature, this red line is the temperature distribution right before you form the star. All right, you see it's basically isothermal until it starts to become optically thick to its own cooling radiation at this radius of like 30 AU, and then it starts to heat up. But it's basically cold outside that. All right, and then here is once I formed a star, and here is a star that is about a tenth of a solar mass. Here's a star that's a little under a solar mass. All right, and so what you see is that you get temperatures now. You've got, you know, significant heating out at like 1,000 AU. All right? And that's simply the radiation. All right, so this is a 1D calculation. Here's a 3D calculation from Matthew Bate. All right, here's density, and here's the temperature distribution. All right, and black here is 10, yellow is 100. All right, and so you're getting significant heating out to respectable distances. All right, now, if you think that, again, the temperature density structure of the gas is important in determining the IMF, this is clearly something you need to pay attention to. It's going to raise the gene's mass. All right, and one way of thinking about this, which I will show you in a moment, is actually a reasonably good way of thinking about it when you check in detail, is that each of these stars has a sort of island around itself. All right, so as soon as I form a star, all right, the densest part collapses first and forms this tiny little seed that's, you know, hundredth of a solar mass but rapidly accreting and has a big accretion luminosity. So this seed then heats up an island of gas around itself. And this island of gas is warm and it can't fragment. It can't go and collapse and make another star because it just doesn't have enough mass to overcome the thermal pressure. All right, so around every star, there's this little zone of forbidden fragmentation. There's this little zone of there's gas around this star. It cannot go and fragment and make another star because it's too warm. So it either has to be ejected or it has to accrete onto that star, onto the already existing star.
That's exactly why Bates' early simulations gave too many low-mass stars.
That's right, because they didn't have this regular feedback. All right, so here is a large-scale simulation of mine, and this one does, in fact, form an IMF. So here's gas density, here's temperature. The conditions here are set up to be like the Orion Nebula cluster, so this is about a parsec in size you're looking at. All right, and each of those white dots is a star. You can see what's happening with the temperature distribution. All right, that flickering you see in the temperature, that's physical. What's causing that is that the accretion rate is...
But what is the mass of the star that you choose to form in the first place?
It's not chosen. It is dictated from the calculation. So what's happening is these are sink particles. So what's going on in the calculation is I have some maximum resolution I'm willing to go to. And then if I violate the Jeans condition on that maximum resolution, I just take any excess mass that exceeds the Jeans mass that I can resolve, put it in a point mass. That point mass starts out with a tiny mass. When it's first formed, it only contains the excess mass that's needed to bring me back below the Jeans mass in the cell. So it's probably born at a mass of 10 to the minus 4 solar masses or something like that. But it can accrete as the calculation continues. If the density in that region violates the Jeans mass again, I again put the extra mass into this point particle. All right, the point particle also accretes, like does Bondi-Hoyle accretion from the gas around it. So I take mass off the grid and stick it on this particle at the Bondi-Hoyle rate. And that causes its mass to grow. All right, and the amount it grows is determined from the simulation. It's not something I put in by hand.
There's a feedback from radiation to the star formation down through temperature, basically, gas temperature.
Yes, there's also radiation pressure in this calculation, but it's not important. I'm not forming stars massive enough that the radiation pressure is important for them. I also have protostellar outflows in. So each of these stars launches an outflow.
When you do it, you do the calculation in non-equilibrium chemical ionization, blah, blah, blah.
There's no ionization here because I'm not forming any stars massive enough.
How do you calculate the temperature without knowing the ionization of the gas?
It's the dust is everything here. I'm at a density here that's high enough that the dust and gas are well coupled. And the dominant source of opacity is the dust. All right, so if I wanted to get, 20 solar mass stars or 30 solar mass stars, then I would need to start worrying about ionization.
Okay.
This calculation does not form any stars that massive. The most massive star I have at the end of this calculation is about 10 solar masses.
And the accretion rate is dependent on the temperature?
Basically depends on the density around the star, around each single particle.
Should depend also on CS cubed, right?
It does. So
increasing the temperature in the island, also the accretion rate on the star should get affected.
If it's dominated, yeah, but that's sort of handled self-consistently in the sense that really what determines how quickly my stars accrete is how quickly the large-scale flow brings gas into them. All right, so, I'm doing a simulation and, the rate-limiting step is not how quickly I choose to put mass onto each star. The rate-limiting step is simply how quickly does my hydrodynamic simulation say mass should flow into the vicinity of each star. So each star has an accretion zone around it of a few cells from which it can feed. All right, and what determines the mass of the star is simply how quickly stuff flows into that zone of a few cells.
So in your calculation, the accretion proceed in a competitive accretion fashion?
Or sorry, say that again?
The accretion proceeds in competitive way? Rather than core accretion.
What is this core accretion? I think the whole competitive versus core accretion thing is sort of, two people looking at something from the same perspective. I think there are aspects of this that look like competitive accretion. There are aspects that look like core accretion.
So the material accreted onto the star comes from the original core, dense core, or the outside the dense core.
It depends on how you define the dense cores, and it's
from the original Jeanson stable envelope.
I think that there's a reasonable correlation between the original sort of Jeanson stable envelope and the final mass of the star, but it's really messy, and it would be really hard to sort of make a having looked at these simulations, I'm convinced that core accretion versus competitive accretion is sort of a red herring. I think it very much depends on exactly how you choose to define cores.
But observationally, the Fermat function and the still IMF has a closed relation with very similar shapes.
Can I defer that question because I could give a very lengthy discussion of how much I believe the observational core mass functions? So, I'd like to go, if you'd like, I would be happy to discuss my concerns about those observations at a future, later on.
And so another question is, how do you put the turbulence?
So in this simulation, so the way I set this simulation up is that I took a periodic box, and I initially had no gravity and no radiation, and I drove turbulence on large scales for a few crossing times until it reached statistical equilibrium. I then turned off the driving and turned on gravity and radiation and let it run.
Final question, promised. How big is the box?
About a parsec.
Sorry, again?
About a parsec.
One parsec.
This box is about a parsec. I don't remember the exact number, but it's of order of a parsec.
Okay, just to understand the scale.
Yeah, about a parsec. The conditions here are chosen to be like the Orion Nebula. Yeah. All right, so we chose our length scale, our density scale, etc., to match the Orion Nebula. All right, and here's the IMF in these simulations. And since I want to show this as a movie, I'm showing you a cumulative rather than a differential mass function, because if you try and do it as a differential, it's sort of impossible to watch as a movie. So here's the cumulative. So what I'm plotting is just what fraction of the stellar mass is in stars whose mass is less than the value on the x-axis. All right, and I'm just showing you how it evolves with time. So the green line is the simulation, and the gray band is a Chabrier IMF. All right, and what's changing in time is simply I am drawing a mass in stars equal to the mass present in the simulation from a Chabrier IMF, and the band is showing you the 90th percentile, the sort of 90% confidence level from
what's
that drawing.
What's the reason for not using a Norman plot?
Sorry, what?
What's the reason for not using a Norman plot?
For not using, for doing it, you mean differential, cumulatively instead of differentially?
Right, IMF has always spoken otherwise.
Because if you try and, I tried that, and you can see it in the paper, but if you try and make a movie of it, the problem is that it's sort of a mess because you don't have very good statistics in any individual bin, and so things sort of go like that.
The total mass of stars that
you've... Yeah, the total mass is, there's only 100 and some solar masses of stars here.
So this is more convincing.
If you, in the paper, you are welcome to look at the actual, we plotted it differentially in the paper.
Okay.
All right, and here is the statistical test.
I'm not getting the paper, I have it here.
Yeah, there you go. Here's the statistical test.
So if you wait longer...
Yes.
Would this evolve and become crazy, or?
I don't think so, because it's staying fairly steady. I mean, the I'm populating the tail more and more as time goes on, just because I'm forming more stars. But, in fact, we have a plot in the paper of what's the median mass versus time, and the median mass is basically stable.
So what is setting your larger mass slope? Is it, do these same particles interact, or it just accretion?
So the sync particles do gravitationally interact with one another. If I play the movie again, you'll see, some of them having n-body interactions. But I think the dominant thing that's going on... No, they're not allowed to merge unless... Once they are past the second collapse mass, once they're massive enough that they've collapsed to stellar densities, they're not allowed to merge. So they can't merge together. All right, so it's not a merging process that's setting it. It's simply that some things are accreting more than others.
What's the freefall time then? Sorry?
In the initial box?
Yes, would you plot against freefall time?
Oh, I don't remember the number, but it's of order 100,000 years. I don't remember the exact number.
What value does the magnetic field have?
That was a non-MHD. I'll show you MHD in a second. So here's MHD. All right, now, with the MHD simulations, unfortunately, we have not run them far enough that we have very good statistics, because they're really expensive when you have MHD and radiation. All right, but we can look at... We do form some stars, and we can look at what's going on around them. So here are some MHD simulations, Aki. All right, radiation MHD. And here are just some samples of regions around stars that have just formed. All right, and we can actually, so I told you to think of the heating as it's sort of creating an island around each star of gas that's too warm to fragment. I can actually examine that in detail. All right, so... Here is just an example of, I've picked out one particular star from one of these simulations, and I've done the following. I've just said, let's just look in sort of concentric shells around this star, and we can calculate what's the density of the gas, what's the temperature, and this is with an appropriate mass-weighted mean temperature, what's the magnetic field strength, again, with an appropriate weighting, all right? And from each of these, so here's just an example, all right, this dip in the center incidentally is where you're starting to see our accretion zone. All right, so that's where we're sort of sucking mass off the grid. All right, so you can say, well, all right, I know the density, I know the temperature, I know the magnetic field. I can ask how much mass is supported against collapse by thermal pressure and by magnetic pressure. All right, and that's what's plotted here. So the black line is the enclosed gas mass just within a given radius. All right, the blue is the Bonnet-Ebert mass calculated using the density and temperature of the enclosed material. So that's how much mass is prevented from collapsing by thermal pressure. All right. The red is the magnetic critical mass. It's the magnetic analog of the Bonnet-Ebert mass. All right. And just for comparison, the green is the Bonnet-Ebert mass we would get if we didn't have radiative transfer and we just fixed the temperature to 10 Kelvin. All right. So this is telling you how the mass that's enclosed compares to the mass that's supported. And just the way to read this is, right, so if I start at small radii, the enclosed mass starts out very small and rises, of course, as I make the radius bigger. All right, if I look at, say, the Bonnet-Ebert mass, the blue line, well, the gas that's closest to the protostar is warm. All right, so the Bonnet-Ebert mass is big, even though the density is relatively high. The gas is warm, and so a lot of mass can be supported by its thermal pressure. As I move outward, as I go to larger radii, the density is falling off, but so is the temperature. And as it turns out, the amount of mass that can be supported by thermal pressure is actually dropping a little or staying about constant. All right, and that's simply because the temperature and density are changing with one another in such a way as to keep the Bonnet-Ebert mass about the same. All right, the magnetic mass you can see goes sort of down and up, and that just has to do with the magnetic field structure around the star. All right, so I can say, well, all right, where do these lines cross, right? So if I'm anywhere to the left of this crossing point, right, then the mass that's enclosed is less than a von Rebern mass. It can't collapse. It is supported by thermal pressure. It could be expelled potentially by, say, protostellar outflow, but it can't go off and make another star, right? So it's either going to be expelled by the outflow or it's going to accrete onto the star that's already there. One of those two things has to happen to it. All right, and similarly, I can have mass supported by, say, magnetic fields. All right, so it's an interesting exercise to ask, if I just repeat this for every sort of sink particle that forms in my simulations, all right, if I just do this exercise and say, where's this crossing point, what does that look like? All right, here's the outcome of that calculation. All right, so x-axis is the mass of the sink particle I'm around. All right, and so it's going from, say, a hundredth of a solar mass, that's when sort of, you know, the thing first appears, up to a few tenths of a solar mass. And the y-axis is what I've called the critical mass. It's just the mass at which the supported mass and the enclosed mass cross. All right, it's this crossing point. All right, and I've calculated that mass both for the von Rebern mass and the magnetic support and for the von Rebern mass with a fixed temperature of 10 Kelvin. So what I would get if I didn't have any radiation. All right, the blue line is what I get for the von Rebern mass. All right, and so you can see it's sort of order a tenth of the solar mass. The red line is the magnetic mass, and the green line is what I would get if I just had no radiation and no magnetic fields. It's just the sort of hydrodynamic von Rebern mass. Now, this is the absolute mass, but maybe a more interesting way of looking at it is this bottom panel. And I should say, I have three different simulations with three different initial magnetic field strengths, strong, weak, and no magnetic fields at all. All right, so these are just three different simulations. Qualitatively, they give you the same answer. All right, so a more interesting way of plotting this is to ask not what's the mass that's supported, but how does the mass that's supported compare to the mass that's already in the star? All right, and that's what's on the bottom here. So this is the supported mass plus the stellar mass divided by the stellar mass alone. All right, so this line 2 corresponds to the star is preventing from fragmenting, it's stabilizing a mass equal to its own. All right, so if I'm below this line, the amount of mass the star is stabilizing is not enough to really change its mass by that much, right? If I accrete all this, who cares? You know, it's going to change my mass 10%. Whereas if I'm above one, if I'm over here, that means the mass that I have stabilized is many times my own mass. I may only have, you know, a 0.02 solar mass object here, but this 0.02 solar mass object is preventing from fragmenting another, you know, tenth of a solar mass around itself. All right, so what you expect is that this stabilization is going to significantly change the mass if you're here and not if you're here. And you can ask, where does that stabilized mass stop being a significant contributor to the mass of the object? And the answer is, order tenth of a solar mass, few tenths of a solar mass. Now, just to be clear, this is not a dimensionless calculation. There's no rescaling that can happen here. All right? So this is the radiation picking out a characteristic mass scale. That's how it happens, all right? Each of these stars has some region around itself that it heats up. That mass determines where the star is going to stop accreting, how much mass it has available to itself. Now, the other thing you'll notice is that the magnetic support is generally not important. Even if I start with an initially strong magnetic field, the magnetic support sort of is competitive down here, but as time goes on, it stays flat, and the radiative mass goes up.
Marty, what's cooling here again?
Dust. The density is high enough that the gas and dust are well coupled, and
you remove the dust a lot.
So if I had zero dust, then this entire calculation makes no sense because right. The light will just escape.
That was not a few.
Sorry, too many people talking.
Wait, let me just finish my. So there's a strong metallicity dependence.
Well, it's not so strong. I'll get to that in two slides. It's not so strong. I'll get to that. Yes.
How did you choose the magnetic field?
So we did three calculations. So what we did is we did one calculation where the mass to flux ratio in units of the critical value was 2, or maybe 1.5, I don't remember. One where it was about 10, and one with no magnetic field. That's strong, weak, and hydro. So that's where the magnetic field just came from. We tried three different strengths.
And with ampipolar diffusion?
No ampipolar diffusion. We don't have...
If you include at least like a soap experiment, ampipolar diffusion, it would decrease the magnetic field in our part.
Probably a little. I don't know that it would make that much difference because these are still, we're looking at, you know, relatively big scales. But yes, if anything, ampipolar diffusion would make this come down.
So if you want to go to the coffee and cookies time, we have to let Mark finish now in 5 minutes. Okay.
All right, metallicity. In fact, here's the next slide. So this is a simulation not of mine, but of Matthew Bates. And here's 10th solar and 3 times solar. And I'm not going to let the movie run to the end in the interest of time. But the bottom line is it actually doesn't change the IMF you get out that much. Here's an earlier study that Andrew Myers did with me. This is over a smaller scale where we change the metallicity. It doesn't matter that much. So why not? The reason is that you don't actually care that much about the total amount of metals. You just want enough that it's optically thick. Because once it's optically thick, once it's opaque, the radiation just diffuses out. And the temperature structure you get doesn't depend that much anymore in the immediate vicinity of the star, right? I mean, if you ask, I have a point source surrounded by an envelope, calculate the temperature of the gas in the envelope. Do you actually care if the optical depth of the envelope is 100 or 1,000 or 1,000,000? No, you get the same solution to the diffusion equation, right?
What is the role of metallicity in your cooling function?
So it's simply the dust abundance. So this is metallicity as a proxy for dust.
Okay. But...
So the cooling, right. So again, remember, we're at a density where the dust is everything. All right. You're used to thinking, I know you're sort of, your intuition is, oh, I should think about carbon 2 and I should think about CO. All of that is totally irrelevant at these densities. The dust completely controls the thermodynamics.
So you haven't mentioned the model you're using for the stellar radiation itself.
So
you mentioned the accretion shock, but how do you compute the accretion shock radius?
Right. So the stellar radius. So what matters for the accretion shock is, of course, what's the stellar radius. The stellar radius is coming out of a protostellar evolution calculation. So it is a one-zone polytrope model, but one that has been calibrated against Hosokawa and Omakai. All right. So. It's a polytrope model, but one that we've checked and it reproduces well Hosokawa and Omakai. All right, and the reason we do that is because we can't use pre-computed tables, because pre-computed tables all are for constant accretion rates, and our accretion rates aren't constant. They're, you know, changing every time step.
But this plays an important role, right?
Yes. And here's the final thing I wanted to get to. All right, so this is the final point I'm going to make. Yes, so the critical parameter here is how much power do I get? All right, and let's see, actually, nice. All right, so yes, the critical parameter is how much power do I get? All right, from accretion. All right, and so yes, so where does that come from? What physics is responsible for picking out the radii of the stars? And now I take you into a like bespoke corner of stellar evolution, which is what sets the radii of accreting protostars? And the answer is deuterium. All right, and the reason is, and this is where I like summon back your stellar evolution course. All right, so what sets the accretion luminosity is, of course, the escape speed from the surface, right? The accretion luminosity is 1/2 m dot v escape squared. What sets the escape speed from the surface of the sun? The answer is the core temperature. For a polytrope, in fact, if you know the core temperature, you know the surface escape speed, and vice versa. Even for something that's only approximately a polytrope, it's approximately true. And the core temperature of the sun is set by hydrogen burning, right? Well, these stars don't burn hydrogen. They're too young, but they do burn deuterium. And that deuterium ignition happens very early while they're still accreting. And just like the core of the sun is thermostated to about 10 to the 7 Kelvin by hydrogen burning, deuterium burning thermostats the core of a protostar to about 10 to the 6 Kelvin. All right? And in fact, you can calculate that number from really nuclear physics, from like fundamental principles. Right, not surprising, you can calculate the core temperature of the sun really from nuclear physics. You can calculate the core temperature of a protostar from nuclear physics, it's 10 to the 6 Kelvin. All right.
That's only true for the low accretion rate cases. For one case, it's okay, but for maybe low metallicity cases, the accretion rate can be higher. And so in that case, the deuterium plays only a rather minor role.
The core, well, so even for a low metallicity, the
low metallicity case is radius is not set by deuterium.
What sets it?
The entropy, the
time it takes to radiate away the entropy. So it depends on the accretion, right? If you accrete rapidly enough, you will never get to deuterium burning. All right, but over a very very wide range of parameters in the modern universe, you will get to deuterium burning pretty quickly. All right, so your deuterium burning, that gives you the radius of your star, that gives you your accretion luminosity. All right, and so you can actually then make a model for what's my sort of heated mass, all right, that you can solve analytically, and if you do that, you get this result. All right, now, it does depend on an interstellar parameter, depends on the, turns out the pressure is the most convenient way to write it. So it depends on the pressure, just like before, you know, I complained about things depending on the genes, on the density. But it depends on the pressure to
the pressure of what?
1/18th power, it turns out.
Pressure of what?
The pressure of the
average of what scale?
Yeah, so averaged over, this is for an idealized calculation where I assume there's a uniform medium, that's obviously unrealistic. You're right, average over what scale? I don't care, raise it to the 1/18th power. Right, I mean, it's, you know, fine, you know, I scaled to 10 to the 6. You don't like it? Go ahead and plug in 10 to the 12. Knock yourself out.
Sure.
Right, I'll see your 6 orders of magnitude and then I'll take it to the 1/18th power. So, all right. I'm going to skip this because I don't want to stop people from coffee. Turns out we can use these same sorts of models to explain the properties of binaries. I don't want to talk about this because of coffee. All right, I'm going to go to the end. I want coffee. All right, the end is, all right, what I want you to take away from this talk is that if you want to explain the IMF, you have two options. You can appeal to the galactic scale or you can appeal to a deviation from isothermality on small scales. You must do one or the other. All right, now, if you appeal to the galactic scale, I would argue that that's tricky to get to work right, in part because you have, you know, some annoying asshole like me is going to come along and keep asking, you know, but why did you choose that density scale or that one, or why did you use this molecule for your line with size relation and not this other one? And it's just annoying. So it's less annoying, maybe because I won't bother you then, if you instead focus on the small scales. All right. Now, I think there's very good evidence from the simulations that people have done that if you change the equation of state, it does make a difference. You can't ignore that effect. Your IMF really does care about what equation of state you put in. And once you've admitted that, then you need to start thinking about the microphysics. What sets the temperature-density relation in your gas? And I've argued that that has to be radiation, that that is the dominant effect in setting the temperature-density relation. All right, and that very naturally gives you a way of explaining the peak of the IMF. There's a very clear physical mechanism. It's this islands of warm gas around stars, and it very naturally gives you that characteristic mass scale where the IMF peaks. So I will end on that.
Two questions. One question, and then we go to coffee, okay?
I have one question regarding the isotropy level of the heating around the star, and possible caveats related to the relative transfer method.
Sure.
So if there is a disk that can somehow shield itself from radiation, then you might heat less the disk, and then all your argumentation kind of loses its strength. Because you don't really change the disk properties because all the radiation is leaking away through the path of least resistance, so to speak. And so how solid is this with respect to this modeling of radiative transfer?
Okay, so I will answer two things. First of all, we're only barely resolving disks in the simulations once we put in the MHD. Once you put in the MHD, the disks just aren't that big. So there are disks, they're just not big disks. They're, you know, sort of 50 AU, 20 AU, and that's sort of our resolution limit. So if you're worried about disks, I can proudly report that we don't have the resolution for that to be a problem. Now, the more general question is, do we have to worry about the isotropy of the radiation field, the limitations of FLD? And the answer is, I think that's a bigger issue if you're concerned about radiation forces than you are for radiation heating. But we have, in fact, developed a variable Eddington tensor method and are rerunning these simulations with it. So I'll tell you in a year. But we have, in fact, we have a working VET method in Orion now. So we'll see.
Okay, so let's thank Mark again.